Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. It's our Friday roundup of the latest news developments with the people who've been covering the stories. And we begin with our WFPL News Roundtable. Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson. Welcome back, everyone.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks.
Gabe Bullard has another excused absence today. He will make his triumphant return to the program next week. We welcome your input today, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. You can call us toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through Facebook. Well, Devin and Philip, let's start with the latest developments with 4th Street Live. Devin, you reported this week that Mayor Greg Fisher has ordered an economic impact study of the entertainment district.
And this is in response, I guess, to a few things that have been going on at 4th Street Live. The Cordish Company announced over the weekend that they were going to be having a new tenant above the sports tavern there in the area in the Kaufman Strauss building. And this is kind of unexpected. We didn't really see this one coming. It's going to be a huge entertainment venue, music. It's going to have restaurants. It's really trying to draw the 30-plus crowd, professional crowd is what they're calling it, into the area. But it's still, I guess, unclear exactly what the whole idea of that whole area is supposed to be growing towards. And Philip, you talked a little bit about the economic impact study in your reporting this week.
Yeah, well, you know, if everyone remembers correctly, the issue with Cordish really became a lightning rod for former Mayor Jerry Abramson over his last term. The Cordish Companies, which is the Baltimore-based developer of 4th Street Live, which opened in 2004, there have been serious questions about the deal that the city has signed, the century-long dollar-a-year lease agreement with the city, which not only includes 4th Street Live, but people often forget that it includes the Center City Project, which would renovate the old Water Company block on 3rd Street, and renovating Louisville Gardens, now just known as the Gardens. The recent situation involves the fact that the controversy in the mayor's office did offer up this sort of botched loan agreement with the Cordish Company, offering then about an $850,000 forgivable loan in taxpayer dollars to move a new tenant into the Kaufman Strauss building. The mayor's office pulled that ordinance and killed it when they found out that new business was one that was already housed in downtown, which is the Learning House. So essentially, the Cordish Company and council members raised this point, was asking for $850,000 to move an existing business only 3 blocks away from where it's currently located. Obviously, there's some more questions that council members had during the government accountability meeting this week, asking, what about this cozy relationship that the mayor's office has with Cordish? Did Cordish mislead the city? Why didn't the city's economic development team ask enough questions? And that was really what we heard at the committee hearing this weekend. Before that hearing is when Mayor Fisher announced the study, saying that they want to look at 4th Street Live, its financial impact and benefit to the city.
And so Fisher put the kibosh, so to speak, on this $850,000 forgivable loan for moving the learning place. But Cordish is going to be seeking another loan for this new tenant, which is called Tavern on 4th, that Devin was talking about.
Yeah, and that's before the March 20th deadline, mm-hmm. To get that additional funds. And this is all part of that original deal that was signed back in 2007 by former Mayor Abramson. One of the interesting things was that came out during the committee meeting, however, was that Mayor Fisher's head of economic growth and innovation, Ted Smith, when he testified before the council, not only did he apologize and admitted that the administration acted too hastily in this recent situation involving the Learning House, but he also said, you know, honestly, and this is the first time maybe I've heard this since reported on the Cordish Companies for about the past 4 or 5 years now, where he admitted that, listen, to have one company that has a monopoly, has so much control of so much important real estate in our city is a bad for our local economic health. And I talked to Councilman Brent Ackerson, who's the vice chair of the Government Accountability, and he also said that part of the problem with this deal is that it's fundamentally flawed in the sense that you have one developer who has so much control for so much important property under so many different contracts that we have to all go over and go back and forth and understand what they mean and what are the ramifications for it. The next big issue for the city is that the September 1st deadline for the renovation or the bonds for the Center City project, the city has the option of opting out of those. Now, the question is that what requirements does the city want Cordish to have looking forward to that project? When they were asked that, at least when the administration was asked that, they didn't have any specific definitions or standards. It's likely that the city will extend that for another year.
Now, Cordish has done this work at sites, cities, I guess, around the world, kind of revitalizing these areas and putting in entertainment districts. And some council members are curious to know what the relationship is between Cordish and other cities, how their contracts have worked, right?
Yeah, the Cordish Company obviously has created entertainment districts in Houston, Texas, Kansas City, all across the country, and you've made an example of the world. There was a study done a few years ago in Toronto when they were working with the Cordish Company that found that its most lucrative deal actually is here in Louisville. Hmm. And that raised the eyebrows of some council members that in the sense of here's the Cordish Company's most lucrative deal here in Louisville, what are the fruits of that tree at this point? 4th Street Live, like I said, is one element of that agreement, but there are still other parts that haven't been fulfilled. And council members want to see in the mayor's study not only what the benefits have been here for Louisville, but how does Louisville compare in its relationship to Cordish with other cities that have seen, perhaps in their view, a larger return on their incentives and other agreements and deals.
Now, who's paying for this study, and when can we expect the results?
Well, it'll cost $10,000. Mr. Smith made it seem like the city didn't have enough funds initially to pay for it, but it's going to be paid by the city. And I believe the Louisville Tourism group here, the group that basically just functions with the tourism, I forget the name. It sort of escapes me at the moment exactly what the group is, their name was, but they're paying a part of the study, which will be conducted by the University of Louisville.
All right, thanks, Philip and Devin. Let's move over to Erica Peterson, WFPL Environment Reporter. There was more news this week, Erica, and the saga involving the state and Louisville Gas and Electric and how to classify this cave, or is it a cave, over in Trimble County. What's going on?
Well, and that's kind of the question at the heart of this. What is a cave and what is protected under state law? As we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Louisville Gas and Electric wants to build a coal ash landfill on some of its property by the Trimble County Power Station. And a coal ash landfill is, of course, it holds all the combustible materials that are left over after coal is burned for electricity. And they do store coal ash on their two properties here in Louisville as well, Mill Creek and Cane Run. But they ran into sort of a problem when the State Division of Waste Management found that there was a cave right in the geographic center of where they want to put this landfill. LG&E basically sent them a letter saying this is not a cave. It is, I believe they called it a cave-like feature, and it's not a cave because of these reasons. And the state responded this week and told them that they basically weren't buying that. They sent LG&E a letter saying that they're going to need to basically hire a professional. It's kind of a problem because there's no speleological certification that somebody can get, but they laid out the requirements of somebody they're going to have to find to basically survey and classify this feature and turn the results in so the state can decide whether this this cave-like feature falls under the state's very pretty protective cave law.
And of course, LG&E is proposing a coal ash landfill at this site. Now, is this something that's happening upon this cave? Is this something the state has had to deal with before?
No, it's definitely not a common thing. Ron Grushevsky is the director of the state solid waste branch, and he said it was unique. It's not something they usually see. Usually, when companies apply for permits like this, the deficiencies the state finds are deficiencies that the company can actually correct. You know, they make a mistake in the application. There's a problem the state has, and the company can shift how they do things a little bit. But he said this is especially unique in that. This is something that if it is decided to be a cave, LG&E can't correct this. There's no way to get around this law.
So if it's determined that this is actually a cave instead of a cave-like feature, what would this mean for the project?
Well, LG&E really isn't saying yet. If it's a cave, they aren't going to be able to put the landfill there. And my understanding is that that's it. I mean, there are no other options for a landfill by that power station. So the options then come down to could they truck the waste from the Trimble County plant to Cane Run or Mill Creek and put it in that landfill? And to do that, they would need PSC approval because that would be something that would be more expensive and would probably raise the rates for people. But LG&E has until mid-November to reply to the state. If they do that sooner, it could help wrap this whole thing up sooner. So I would guess they're going to try to do that. But it could be a while before we have an answer.
Okay, thank you very much, Erica. This is State of the News on WFPL. And again, we welcome your input at 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Or toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Devin, let's go back to you and back to the Metro Council, because you covered the first of two public hearings this week on some controversial changes proposed to the city's landmarks ordinance.
Yeah, the first of the public comments was earlier this week. It got a huge showing. About 20 people mm-hmm. got up to speak, both for and against this new proposed landmarks ordinance. What it will do, essentially right now, the way things are, 200 countywide residents need to sign on for a structure or a district to get a landmark hearing. What this ordinance would do would first give Metro Council final say over what becomes or what gets the landmark hearing, but also it would require 200 out of those 200 signatures. That 101, or roughly 51%, come from residents within 1 mile radius of that potential landmark. It would also say either that or 10% of the total resident population within a 1 mile. So say there's not, you know, say there's 800 residents in that area, only 80% of those or 80 signatures would have to be gotten from residents within that area. There was some, I guess, misinformation as far as Councilman David Yates was concerned regarding this ordinance, because he kept hearing, you know, certain things such as 50% of residents within this 1 mile area. And that's a lot of what a lot of people spoke about at the meeting. But there are arguments for both sides. For example, the two very distinguished groups which I saw in the meeting were one group, which was developers and real estate groups, which were in support of the ordinance for reasons of developing certain areas. Then you saw another group, which was essentially residents preservation groups, historical groups, which were really against this, saying that any kind of change to the current way that things are done will really take away some of the structures that are in Louisville. And they said that the total county should really have more say over what structures are preserved in the area.
Now, as you mentioned, David Yates is sponsoring this. What is his rationale for suggesting these changes?
And some of these changes, real briefly, is that he's open to talks on some of these changes. So when I talked to him after the meeting, he said, you know, and some people actually mentioned, some of the people who were up there talking said, why not make it 5 miles? Why not make it a little bit bigger? And that's something that he said he'd be open to talking about, which is why he's holding these public meetings, which is why it was tabled earlier this year to have these and hold these meetings. As far as changes to the landmarks ordinance, he wants to see more development in certain areas, and I think that's really where it stems from.
So this hearing was held here downtown, and then there's a second one out in the community, right?
Yeah, it'll be, I believe, April 6th, later on in the, I believe, south side of Louisville. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks, Devin. Philip, let's go back to you. You reported yesterday that a decision came down in Indiana under which longtime U.S. Senator Richard Lugar is no longer eligible to vote. What's going on?
It seems like a strange issue that, longtime U.S. Senator Richard Lugar may lose a vote, and it might be his own in his upcoming reelection bid. The election board in Indiana, the Marion County Election Board, made a ruling along party lines in a 2-1 vote that disqualified the residency of Senator Lugar and his wife from his home precinct, ruling that he is ineligible to vote. Many may know that, so the story, longtime story with Senator Lugar, is that when he was elected in 1977, he actually owns a home in Northern Virginia in the D.C., Washington, D.C. area. He's lived there really ever since, and he's really been derided by critics both in the Democratic Party and his GOP challenger, Richard Murdoch, who's challenging him in the Republican primary about not living it actually in the state. Senator Lugar for years has cited different legal opinions and a loophole in the state law that allows him to do such. This ruling by the election board, which Senator Lugar's team says that they will appeal, basically means that he will have to establish new residency. He does own a farm in Indiana. He could do it there. He could re-register to vote with a relative who lives in. He just has to have a physical location somewhere in Indiana that he actually resides in. So this doesn't mean that he won't be able to vote in his election or that he's disqualified from office, but it does sort of hamper him once again, sort of similar to what's going on in Utah with U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch, who's facing a Tea Party challenger. You have a longtime Republican incumbent who is getting a challenge from the right, and this certainly won't help Senator Lugar in that quest to be reelected.
So he lists, I guess, his Virginia residence as his address, but he claims this loophole allows him to vote as an Indiana resident.
Yeah, and I believe in the late 1980s, an attorney general opinion actually gave that a rubber stamp as well. It's just this has been a controversy for a long period of time. I know that when I first heard about it earlier this year, it sort of made me scratch my head, the idea that a senator doesn't live in the state that he represents. And this first came out when they, I believe someone did an open records request and found a number of hotel bills Senator Lugar had had over the past decade to show he had spent X amount of dollars staying in hotels when he visits Indiana and doesn't actually live there. So that may have a lot of people who, you know, have U.S. senators and representatives think this person does live in my area. In this case, Senator Lugar does not.
I wonder what the numbers are on that. I know Senator McConnell has a home here in Louisville and has for a long time, but has a residence in the Washington area too.
I believe there was a Tea Party congressman who, the controversy with him was that he was, he didn't even have a hotel room or a condo in D.C. He was actually living in his office and showering in the congressional gym. I forget his name.
Oh, wow. Okay. Maybe we don't need to know that anyway.
Too much information.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Erica Peterson, back to you. You reported this week that there is a new report out that advises Kentucky to start kind of rethinking the way it it treats its coal severance funds. First of all, what does Kentucky do with its severance funds?
Well, right now there's a tax of 4.5% of the value of the coal that's extracted here, and that goes into the state's coal severance fund. And half of that money goes directly to the state's general fund for, you know, for whatever the state chooses to use it for. The other half is broken up in various ways. Some of it is designated for special programs for coal fields counties. A little bit of it goes just directly to coal fields counties, their government, but it's all. The idea is that half of it goes back to the counties where the coal was extracted.
So what does this report suggest?
Well, basically, this report points to data that that is looking like the outlook for coal, especially in the Appalachian region, not so much in western Kentucky, but definitely in eastern Kentucky. It's showing that the outlook for coal is not very good and that it's going to start declining pretty steeply over the next couple of decades. And then, of course, you know, as coal declines, so will the coal severance tax paid to the state, one could reasonably assume. Yeah. So this report argues that we need to start setting aside some of that money, because once coal is gone, there is going to be a need for economic diversification in some of these areas in eastern Kentucky, and we're going to have a huge budget gap that we're used to filling in with coal severance funds. So the report advocates for the creation of what's known as a permanent fund. And that's basically, it's what foundations use. You put some money aside and you just leave it there, and you can pay yourself dividends as it grows and use that money for the programs that that you want. But there's some money that just stays there and creates kind of a nest egg for the future. And the reason this report is being released now and is especially timely is because the legislature is talking about what to do with some of these coal severance funds. There was a proposal that they moved the University of Pikeville into the state system that didn't go over so well among some. So now the proposal is to use coal severance funds to create a scholarship for people in far eastern Kentucky who want to go to private colleges. And this report is basically arguing that a scholarship fund may be, you know, maybe great, maybe it's a great idea, but it'd be a better idea to put the money into a permanent fund and use some of those dividends to create the scholarship fund so we have something left in a couple of decades.
And who? What is the group that issued this report?
It's MACED, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. It's based in Berea.
Okay, thank you very much, Erica. Let's go back to you, Devin. You reported that the Kentucky Senate will decide whether to send Governor Beshear a bill that would create this panel that would provide more oversight for the Cabinet for Health and Family Services.
This received a large amount of support from the House and a unanimous vote from the House. And this is in response, a large in part, to the transparency issues that the Cabinet has had to deal with in the past year, especially in the media. But some of these lawmakers have really been trying to fight transparency issues with the Cabinet for the past 10 years, some of them say. Susan Westrum, who introduced the bill, sponsored the bill, says that the media was really behind the push, she thought, to really get this panel together. And what it will do, it'll form an external panel that will review some of the records that the Cabinet considers private currently, and that's still being decided in court. You know, some of three newspapers have a lawsuit against the Cabinet trying to get a hold of certain records. They're releasing them, but they're redacting a lot of information that they think is imperative to finding out how the Cabinet is doing as far as the work with especially child and child services. So this was unanimously supported, bipartisan supported, and both cabinets have been working, both the Senate and the House have been working really hard to kind of form legislation that will eventually open up the transparency of the Cabinet.
And again, this is in the hands of the Senate now.
Yeah, this hasn't been assigned, as far as I saw, to a specific committee. They are expecting, Susan Westrom is expecting it to be decided pretty, or to work through the Senate pretty quickly. Again, just advocate groups have been on this, and a lot of committee meetings have been happening. A lot of panels have been hearing a lot from outside people coming in and talking about various cabinets in other states. So this is going to be something to watch in the next couple weeks.
And along those lines, a big announcement yesterday from the governor that he has appointed a new secretary for the Cabinet of Health and Family Services.
Audrey Taze Haynes will be the new secretary for the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. She'll be replacing Eric Friedlander, who is stepping in the interim after Janie Miller resigned last month. Miller was the second kind of head agency person to resign within the past couple months. And again, this may have something to do with the controversy surrounding the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. Haynes comes from, she has a large background. A lot of it's administrative. She was the former Clinton administrative staff, the director of women's initiatives and outreach in the Clinton administration. She was the head of the YMCA, or excuse me, the chief government affairs officer of the YMCA of the USA. She has bachelor's and master's in social work, which is what a lot of lawmakers are actually trying to get pushed through the General Assembly as well, to make sure that everyone working within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, or at least the Child Welfare Services, has the adequate kind of education to really work in the cabinet.
And she is a Kentuckian, a native Kentuckian.
Yeah, from Adair County. Went to Adair High School, got both her degrees from Spalding as well as University of Kentucky in social work.
And before we run out of time, Devin, I want to touch on an education issue, because you also reported that the Jefferson County School Board has approved Thomas Jefferson Middle School's decision to restaff at least half its teachers.
Right, and Thomas Jefferson Middle is a persistently low-achieving school, mm-hmm. according to No Child Left Behind. It's the fifth school in the latest round to be deemed persistently low-achieving to make their final decision. The other four schools earlier this year were all approved for the transformation model, which essentially allows them to keep teachers but to provide professional development and to create certain goals. The restaffing means that Thomas Jefferson Middle will get rid of essentially half their instructional staff, half their teachers, and hire new teachers. Now, Assistant Principal John Rock was saying that a lot of the teachers that they took on in the past year or two have actually been teachers who have already been through the audit process and who are already not rehired by some of their schools. So this will allow them to start afresh with setting up a job description online where they can get people not through the transfer process of JCPS.
Now, in the past, there's been some federal money available to help these schools with these transformations or these changes. Is that still available?
For some cohorts, for some of the groups, it is. For the first group of PLA schools, persistently low-achieving schools, 3 years are allocated in the federal budget to provide them with funding. The second group just was announced yesterday, and really today, that the second group will get the second year of their third year of funding. The third group, which has five JCPS middle schools, including Thomas Jefferson, are not guaranteed any federal funding at this point. The state education department is trying to work through getting some sort of funding through the state budget, but that's still uncertain.
All right, that's going to wrap up our first segment with our WFPL roundtable. Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
When we come back, we'll talk more General Assembly news and news from the state capitol with Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Still ahead in the program, we're going to talk with Jerry Downs from the Courier-Journal about the auto industry, specifically Ford and the suppliers for Ford and other automotive plants in this region. We're also going to hear a report from Tracy Samilton of Michigan Radio regarding the creation of thousands of jobs, not only in the auto industry, but in the supplier industry as well, and the effect that's having on those industries. That's coming up shortly. And a little bit later on, we're going to be talking with Eric Crawford from the Courier-Journal about March Madness. UK, U of L, Murray State, Indiana, all still in the big dance, going to be playing this weekend, and Eric will talk about those games and others coming up a little later in the program. Right now, we're going to talk Frankfort and the Kentucky General Assembly with Kentucky Public Radio's Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Kenny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So are the lawmakers back in session today?
They did come in session today. The House actually had a kind of busy day. They passed the three road plan bills, obviously the transportation budget, that cabinet's budget. They passed the two-year road plan, and they passed a joint resolution, which has the effect of law, but basically that's the what's called the six-year plan. It's the other 4 years, and it's kind of the wish list of everybody, kind of gives them a blueprint for 2 years from now what they want to do again. So the House passed all three of those bills and promptly sent them to the Senate and passed a few other small changes bills as well.
Now, this time of year, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume there is a direct correlation between the amount of legislative business that gets accomplished and who's playing in the basketball tournament at a particular time.
You know, that's funny because it usually happens, but if you remember during the SEC tournament, we kind of made fun of, and a lot of people wrote stories about how Senator David Williams and a lot of the lawmakers were going down to New Orleans and weren't doing any business. Well, I think the lawmakers got a little offended at that because yesterday was one of the busiest days in Frankfurt I've ever seen. I mean, we have a new cabinet secretary that's appointed. The UPike report comes out. The House passed, I think, some dozen bills. The Senate had their biggest agenda that they ever had yesterday, and you had Murray, you had more, you had Louisville, and you had Kentucky playing. So I think they got a little offended, I guess a week ago when we were making fun of them. So they're kind of doing work now, although I will give you this point. One of the House lawmakers during debate today, when someone asked if they could ask him a question, did say, well, you know, my participation in this is contingent on when those basketball games start. So as long as you can get that question in before those games start at noon, I'll answer your question.
Well, the good news is all the teams play tomorrow, so there could be some additional games, depending on how they do, there could be some additional games during the week next week. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, you're correct. But the interesting thing is let's say all the Kentucky teams advance, which they can do. Sorry for Western Kentucky. Obviously, they've lost to Kentucky last night. But, let's say Kentucky goes to Atlanta. You know, that's, I think, a Friday-Sunday matchup. But if Kentucky was to play on Thursday, that could absolutely wreck tomorrow next week's schedule, right when the Senate's taking up the budget. So you have a point, basketball rules this time of year.
Well, it is what it is, I guess, as people say. But let's talk about some of the business that has been conducted. You mentioned the budget. Where does it stand now?
Well, the Senate has the budget in their hands. They've had it for about a week. They've had a lot of meetings, a few committee meetings, but nothing really publicly. I expect the Senate to pop out their changes to the budget this upcoming week. I don't know exactly what day. There's some confusion on how quickly the Senate will cobble together all those proposals, but it could be early this week. Senate leadership is meeting over the weekend to hammer out the final details of the budget. So I would expect the Senate to come out this week. We already know there will be changes. The question is, are there changes that the House can go with, or are they talking about monumental changes? And I would be surprised if they're monumental changes, because neither side is really acting like they're going to go into a special session, that they're going to have to stop the clocks or, you know, not be able to get this budget out on time. So I think you'll see the budget pop out of the Senate. You know, obviously, this coming up week, you could have conference committees set up by Thursday or Friday, and, they could work over the weekend, obviously basketball allowing. But, you know, going into that last week, conference could come together, and they actually pass a budget out on time that, you know, they don't have to worry about vetoes from the governor with, because they'll have time to override those vetoes.
And a couple of drug-related measures. Where do we stand on the pseudoephedrine regulation bill?
The pseudo bill will probably come up for a committee vote on Monday. The House Judiciary Committee has a special meeting planned. Obviously, that agenda has not been posted yet. That's what happened this week when the Senate Bill 2 came up. You know, it was kind of last minute, but they have it for upon adjournment on Monday, so that would be Monday evening. We're talking, 5-6 o'clock. My expectation is with the changes that bill probably passes. House Speaker Greg Stumbo supports the bill. That's obviously a big hurdle you have to clear anytime you have a bill in the House. And, I think there will be some floor amendments that take away some of the restrictions, make it a little bit more relaxed, but I don't know that those amendments will pass. I think the bill that we saw come out of the Senate will basically pass the House. When it comes to the synthetic drug bill, I believe that'll pass the Senate. I don't see a lot of changes there. And really, the only other thing drug-related that we're looking at is House Bill 4, whether the Kentucky Medical Association and their lobbying efforts weakens that bill in the Senate or not.
Now, would the pseudoephedrine bill still require a prescription?
No, what the compromise on this PSE bill does is that it allows anybody over the counter to get 7.2 grams of pseudoephedrine containing medicine a month. You know, your Sudafed, your Mucinex, that's roughly two boxes. After that, you can go to a doctor. If you need more than that, let's say you have asthma or allergies, you can go to a doctor and a doctor can prescribe 7.5 grams a month. And so basically, you know, what they're saying is that basically you can have, you know, four boxes at a time, you know, before, and it's a 24-gram annual limit. So basically they say, you know, for the average person, this will give you four or five boxes a year. You know, this will take care of two boxes in the springtime, two boxes in the fall where everybody gets their stuffy nose. And then if you, you know, have a long-term, if you're taking it for maintenance, for symptoms related to asthma or allergies, this will, the doctor's prescription will allow you to take the lower dosage pills all year long without, you know, you'd have to see a doctor, but it would allow you to get those prescriptions all year long.
And you mentioned synthetic drug crackdown. Are we talking about the so-called bath salts and that sort of thing?
That's exactly what we're talking about. And the legislature has passed one of these bills every session. And what they're doing now is that they're basically saying, listen, you all change these chemical compounds and these names faster than we meet every year. So we're going to take a look at that. We're going to attack the compounds. That's what we're going to do. If you change this drug or if you simulate this effect of, you know, let's say marijuana or cocaine or something like that, it is still the same offense. You know, we're not attacking individual drugs now. We are going after the chemical compounds, and then that way it doesn't matter how you change it chemically or if you change its name. If we catch you, you're in trouble.
Sounds like some really nasty stuff, that these the bath salts. There's really been a lot of horror stories coming out of, you know, the abuse of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane. The Representative John Tilley, who has shown videos of just it looks like 18-year-old kids who are just out of their mind. I mean, just laughing hysterically one minute and then having the most confused look, scared look on their faces. I mean, the testimony and everything else on this, it's been wild. It is quite crazy. And in some cases, apparently, you can just walk into your neighborhood convenience store and buy these things. So that's what lawmakers want to do. They want to take that out. They're going after some of these convenience stores who sell these things, and they're really saying, you know what, we're tired of these little fixes. We're going all in on ending this problem.
On another topic, excuse me, there's been a lot of wrangling over the possible addition of the University of Pikeville to the state university system. Where does that stand?
Well, that bill has been changed to more of a scholarship program for those in Eastern Kentucky that, you know, college juniors or seniors who probably have gone through 2 years of community college can go to UPike, go to the University of the Cumberland, any of those private colleges or any of the public partnerships that Morehead or Eastern Kentucky has, and finish their four-year, get a four-year bachelor's degree. They get some scholarship money with that. Also, the UPike report that Governor Steve Beshear commissioned came out yesterday. It basically said, yes, making UPike a public school would obviously help raise education levels in that area, but the report said they didn't think it would raise it enough and that they would be better off collaborating more and doing the scholarship program like the UPike bill now does. Of course, Speaker Stumbo ripped that proposal, says, you know, these people are from out of state. They don't know what goes on there. I live in that area, and UPike would do wonders. So basically, it's the second verse, same as the first, and they'll probably pass that scholarship bill out this session, and next session, the UPike discussion will probably come right back up.
Where are we on the session's timetable? Are we kind of nearing the end?
Yeah, well, I mean, Monday will be day 50, and that'll be basically 10 or 11 days. So there's a lot of issues we talk about every week, and those issues haven't passed both chambers in the same form. So, you know, they'll have to get the budget out. After they do the budget, if everything goes as planned, they'll probably have 3 or 4 days, just regular days, for them to try to hatch compromises on other bills, either these drug bills, the dropout age, numerous things that we've talked about. And then they'll go home for roughly 11 days, let the governor see what he vetoes, a line item in the budget or overall bills, and they'll come back for one day on April 12th and try to override those vetoes. So basically, I mean, we're down the last quarter, we're down the stretch they come. So lawmakers are probably going to be scrambling. We'll have a busy next 2 weeks here.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks again for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
This is State of the News on WFPL. American automakers have created thousands of new jobs, and the auto industry's expansion has created tens of thousands of jobs at auto suppliers. As Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports, this has suppliers scrambling to fill those jobs and orders for parts.
Bridgewater Interiors in Warren, Michigan has picked up the pace. The factory's hundreds of union employees are busy filling a growing number of orders. The factory floor is jam-packed with stacks of foam cushions and seat covers and headrests. Ron Hall is vice president of the company. He slaps on some safety glasses and a bright yellow vest for the tour. He points to a big blinking screen overhead.
So we have a computer system that's linked to, in this case, Ford Motor Company's Dearborn truck plant.
That link enables Ford to tell Bridgewater exactly what kind of seats it needs for each truck moving down the auto company's assembly line 30 miles away.
And so, we've got to be able to get that exact configuration and do it in about a 3.5 hour window and do it all in sequence.
This factory was not so busy a few years ago. Consumer demand fell so fast, so hard, that people who study the industry had to go way, way back to World War II to find another time when per capita Americans had bought so few cars. And with two big customers, GM and Chrysler, going bankrupt,
suppliers were terrified.
Sean McElinden is an economist with the Center for Automotive Research.
A lot of them thought they'd go down to one plant, like one heartbeat a minute.
In fact, for many, the heart stopped beating. Hundreds of suppliers went bankrupt. Hundreds more didn't even bother to file for bankruptcy. The owners just sent their workers home, locked the doors, and walked away.
There's a machinery inside with no tooling, but it's covered in dust and no workers, right? Such plants would take months to fire back up.
Bridgewater Interiors laid off hundreds of its workers. Michigan Automotive Compressor, a non-union plant in Jackson, Michigan, offered a buyout to its employees. For those who stayed, at least there were no layoffs.
They actually allowed us to have Fridays off.
For no pay. Darren Dungy has worked at the company they call Mackey for 11 years, Lori Cervantes for 16.
Just had to cut out on things that weren't important until things got better. We just rode out the storm.
While Bridgewater Interiors has rehired everybody it laid off, workers at Mackey are sometimes putting in as much as 3 hours overtime a day, 6 days a week. Still, Dungy says he doesn't hear many complaints.
Going through that spell, what I found out on my line is associates are a little bit more appreciative of what they got.
In a dramatic reversal, many suppliers, after improving efficiency, downsizing, giving buyouts, and the like, find themselves shorthanded. At the same time, when it comes to hiring new people,
we're trying to be very careful.
Jerry Kerfus is head of human resources at Mackey.
There's still a lot of hesitancy about the future just because of where we've been in 09 and, and seeing companies come so close to the brink and wanting to make sure that we don't go there.
This is a very major concern. If we reach the 15 million sales level for a year,
and sales were nearly 13 million just last year,
the industry will reach a choke point.
Meaning, says economist Sean McElinden, a shortage of parts, hence a shortage of cars. He says the supplier industry will need 174,000 additional workers by 2015, and the pace of hiring right now appears to be too slow. When all those supply companies went dark, many skilled tradesmen, machinists, and engineers moved on. Ron Hall of Bridgewater Interiors suspects a lot of people are on the sidelines right now.
They don't know whether to believe if the recovery is real. We're here living it, and we've been living it long enough now for, 2 years, that we know that it's real.
Meanwhile, car companies are upping their forecasts for car sales this year. Suppliers say no matter what happens, they're absolutely committed to doing what it takes to meet the demand today and the demand tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
Thank you, Tracy. The resurgence of the auto industry is, of course, being felt here in the Louisville area with the retooling of Ford's Louisville Assembly Plant, which has created thousands of jobs. There's also a demand for parts, of course. And here to talk about all of this is Jerry Downs, who covers the auto industry for the Courier-Journal. Welcome back, Jerry.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you with us again. Well, let's talk about this catch-up on the Ford plant, first of all. The Escape, the new Escape will start rolling off the line soon, right?
Well, just this week, about 3,300 workers started overlapping shifts on Monday to go into final production of the Escape.
And they're expecting big things, I assume. This vehicle's become very popular.
Well, this vehicle was the top-selling compact sport SUV in the U.S. last year, beating out the Toyota RAV4 and the Honda CR-V.
So let's talk about suppliers. Did we have, when the recession hit, did we have a lot of the suppliers kind of dry up here in this region?
Well, the Louisville region lost about 1,100 manufacturing jobs since December of 2007. A lot of those are auto-related. To make 200,000 Escapes, which is how many Ford sold last year, the Louisville Assembly Plant is going to, I have a list here of about 50 suppliers who supply everything from mirror buttons to liftgate handles to pistons and side grills. And many of those suppliers are local. So yes, they are hiring. Rick, the story is that jobs are coming back, but at lower wages.
Yes, exactly. Now, as Tracy mentioned, there was some concern about filling these jobs or having the skilled workers to fill these jobs. Is that something we're looking at here in this area?
Well, that remains to be seen with record high unemployment continuing. And frankly, Louisville has a pretty uneducated workforce overall. People are desperate for jobs. Just in the last 2 days, General Electric advertised for 230 new jobs building refrigerators for $13.03 an hour. They got 10,000 applications in about 48 hours.
Now, as Ford filled all these jobs that they created with the retooling of the plant?
Well, what's happening over at the Louisville Assembly Plant on Fern Valley Road is there are 3,300 auto workers there now on two shifts. Of those, 200 of the new hires are making $15.51 an hour. That's about half of the veteran UAW wage. So that's a dramatic example of how wages are declining, although the jobs are coming back.
The unions made a lot of concessions as those jobs, you know, as the recession hit. And
they certainly have. You asked about a labor shortage. What I see happening is that I'll see skilled people with a background in skilled manufacturing, machine operators, stamping press operators who know what they're doing. They might work at a GE or a supplier job for $13 an hour. And then when something else comes open for $17, $18, they'll jump.
Yeah.
So the new picture will be, the new thing to look at will be, what is turnover like? And frankly, how does that affect quality at Ford and suppliers? And, you know, but Toyota's been doing it for a year. Toyota's been had a temp program of people earning about half what permanent associates make for years. And they can do it, but it's difficult.
Now, officials have said for every automotive job created, there are seven spinoff jobs. Do you agree with that?
I think that's fair to say. That looks at everything. That would have to look at concessionaires, you know, food suppliers to the plant, vendors, the cleaning companies that come in, the paint suppliers. But that seems fair to say. I've got this list here of 50 different suppliers for Escape. There's a lot of pieces that go into a car.
Jerry Downs covers the auto industry and other news for the Courier-Journal. Jerry, thanks for stopping in and chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. When we come back, we'll talk with Jerry's colleague, Eric Crawford of the Courier-Journal, about March Madness. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, we promised to talk college basketball and March Madness with Eric Crawford of the Courier-Journal. We're having trouble making a connection with him at this point. We'll try to get to him in just a moment. So Jerry Downs has graciously agreed to stick around and talk more about, I'm glad because we kind of ran short on time, talk about not only the auto industry, but some new things going on with General Electric. Let me ask you a couple of more questions about Ford. We haven't spoken much about the truck plant here in Louisville. How is it faring?
Oh, that's a really great question. You know, gas prices, as everyone knows, have been trending upward for 4 weeks and are expected to peak about above $4 in the first week of May. What that's going to do to heavy-duty pickup trucks, no one can say. I can tell you that in 2008, when gas last peaked at $4.25 around here, you could get a Super Duty at auction for about $8,000.
Wow.
You could steal it.
Wow.
So whether pickup sales will get hit hard. Now, here's why that's important to Ford Motor Company. Those babies are cash cows.
Mm-hmm.
The Super Duty produces more profit per vehicle for Ford than anybody else.
All right. And we do have Eric. Before we let you go, you were going to mention that the head of GE is going to be in town this week.
Right? I did. A corporate rock star, Jeffrey Immelt, mm-hmm. will come in to talk Tuesday night for Greater Louisville, Inc., our region's Chamber of Commerce. And he'll be here to note GE's huge billion-dollar investment in returning American manufacturing jobs and the opening of a new bottom freezer refrigerator line at Appliance Park.
All right. Jerry, thanks for sticking around and talking to us about the latest developments, the auto industry and the other industries in the area.
I thought nothing was more important than basketball.
Well, I was going to ask you for your picks, but I know you're not interested in that. So we'll move on
thanks,
to Eric
Rick.
Crawford. Thanks, Jerry. This is State of the News on WFPL. Well, the NCAA men's basketball tournament is in full swing. U of L, UK, Murray State all won their first round games yesterday in the Big Dance, and we'll resume play tomorrow. Also, Indiana was a winner. And, of course, office pools everywhere are up and running. Here to help us break it all down is Courier-Journal sports columnist Eric Crawford. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Well, now, what did you cover yesterday? Were you at the UK Western game?
I am in Louisville, so it just feels weird to be in town for the NCAA tournament. But it's been really nice. So, yeah, I had Kentucky and Murray in the regional here.
Now, let's start with the UK Western. Let's start with the Hilltoppers, the team that saw its head coach fired around midseason, and then they made this amazing turnaround under Ray Harper.
Well, they're a very young team, and, you know, as young teams do, they did get better late in the year, but I think that it was more than just your usual improvement. Obviously, you know, Ray is a talented coach. He's had success at every level that he's been at, and I think one of the reasons you saw them take away the interim tag from his title was just that he helped recruit these guys and they were comfortable with him. And it's a case where they did make a change, but there was some continuity, and it was just a good mix. And they won their final six games and got into the NCAA tournament, which was a surprise enough, won a tournament game with President Obama in attendance in Dayton on Tuesday night, and, of course, lost to Kentucky. But they really finished the year with a lot to build on.
Let's talk about Kentucky. A lot of folks picking them to win it all. What would be their biggest vulnerability to keep them from doing that?
Well, I think one problem they might have is they're getting to the point now where any off game presents a danger to you. You know, they could come in and have an off night and somebody could beat them. But I don't really, you know, they are the overwhelming favorite in this tournament. They are by far the most talented team in this tournament, and so I think at that point you just start to look for internal factors that might trip you up. There is a lot of pressure on this team. There's a lot of pressure on Coach John Calipari, who has been coming close in recent years but not gotten there. I think maybe dealing with that weight of those expectations, while they wouldn't probably acknowledge it as a factor, is a factor, and if they get into close games, that's going to be something that weighs on that team.
Out west in Portland, Rick Pitino's Louisville Cards held off Davidson yesterday. They'd lost their opening round game the previous 2 years. New Mexico's up next. How deep can Louisville go?
Well, it's going to be interesting. This is a huge game coming up for them on Saturday night, late Saturday night, 9:30 Louisville time. They're playing a New Mexico team that really doesn't have any obvious weakness. They're a very solid team. But if they can get through this game and make it through the first weekend of the tournament, for the first time in 4 years, I think it lifts a lot of the pressure off of this group and puts them in a position to maybe surprise some people and go even further. Rick Pitino's never lost in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. So this is a huge game for them for a lot of reasons coming up Saturday night. It's certainly a game, a winnable game for them, but it is they're playing a long way from home against a team from the western part of the U.S. that's pretty good. So if they win this one, they could go another step or two.
And Murray State had an impressive season. At one time, the only undefeated team in the country. Their attitude seems to be, we should be here and we're going to go far, but they've got a tough opponent tomorrow in Marquette.
They do. Marquette is a type of team that can give them trouble. Marquette has quality interior players and size. Murray is a very good team. They're a very gifted offensive team. They don't have a lot of size. So, you know, Marquette can pose them trouble in that respect. But Marquette is a team that likes to play the kind of game that Murray plays, an up-and-down game. Their last game before the NCAA tournament, they played against Louisville, and Louisville beat them pretty handily, playing an up-and-down, faster-tempo game. That's what Murray wants, and so Murray is at least going to get an opponent that, from a style standpoint, will be a good matchup, and we'll see if they can do the little things like rebound and take care of the ball and things like that to get through that round.
Just about 10 seconds left, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Bellarmine Knights. They return to action in Division II next week.
Lost their starting center in the regional tournament and still won it. Scotty Davenport has won 9 NCAA tournament games in a row. A great accomplishment for them to get back to the Elite Eight, certainly.
Eric Crawford with the Courier-Journal. Thanks for joining us, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, that's all the time we have for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, a production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.